From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Tony Whedon, whose essay collection, Drunk in the Woods, was just nominated for the Vermont Book Award. He is a poet, essayist, and musician. Over the past two decades, his writing has appeared in over 100 prominent literary magazines. He's also a performing jazz trombonist and leads the poetry jazz ensemble PoJazz and the Border Band. Tony spends his summers with his wife Suzanne at their rural, peaceful cabin in the woods of Vermont. Winter finds them in their bungalow in the Bayou of Georgia, where Tony performs locally and continues his writing and poetry. Tony and I began our conversation by talking about the Vermont Book Award and his recent nomination. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
That's for Drunk in the Woods. Well, that's a collection of essays.
Okay.
And they were written over a period of many years, maybe like 15, 20 years.
Oh, wow.
They were done, let's see how you would say this. They were done over a period from when I got sober 30 years ago till just a couple of years ago.
Okay.
They're not written as a chronology, like, you know, year one, year two, like that's not the way it's done. I did it. It was, and they were just contemplations of nature. And I think as I got farther and farther away from my sobriety date, which was 1990, I got more interested in other things than writing about recovery, which becomes rather redundant. And for me, I kept on stepping in the same stream over and over again in terms of the same narrative.
Right.
So, it evolved that way. And they're nature, they're partly nature essays and they're partly recovery essays. But I put the emphasis on nature or in Vermont.
Right.
And living in a small cabin in which gradually got bigger as I got raises from my job at Johns Estate. I put an addition on the house and we got electricity. But for 12 years, and a lot of this covers a 12-year period before I got sober, we lived in this one-room cabin without electricity or running water, and we lived off the grid about six times longer than Thoreau did.
Wow.
Every one of those essays, well, except maybe one or two, and there are 18 of them, were published in major magazines, you know, Shenandoah.
Oh, yeah.
Plowshares, that kind of stuff.
Right, that's great.
So they were all, you know, pretty well-tested things. And I put them together, and I think the book evolved as it got rejected. And I kept rewriting them and putting more stuff in. So they were, in a way, they're, I guess you could call them lapidary essays in the sense that, they're kind of worked.
Yeah. Okay, so you did send me, in anticipation of this interview, you sent me three poems, and they're new, they're not published yet, and that's exciting. So let's talk about those. I wonder if we could start with you actually reading the first one, which is Tachycardia.
Okay. Tachycardia. The storm came fast and was nearly gone before I went out to check the damage. A patio table tossed over, our sweet princess of a garden statue snared in vines. A wild down-home rocker of an ocean storm, and I felt your heart, your poor heart, beating next to me, your breath coming way too fast. A slash of lightning preceded by throat-clearing rumbles somewhere west of the island. Then you were awake, your voice soft as a prayer. Nothing's to be done about it, you said, and promptly fell back to sleep.
Thank you for reading that. So I do have the sense that this is about a story, so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, it is a story. I have to talk a little bit about the series of poems that this comes out of.
Okay.
Back in the winter, my wife had symptoms of heart failure, and we went to the hospital, and an emergency run to the hospital. It turned out she had heart failure. We were told that she was not going to live.
Oh.
That and she needed to go into hospice. And for 2 or 3 months, we were terrified. And it turned out it was a misdiagnosis.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they, it was a tragic mistake on behalf of the doctors. And we took her to a hospital in Jacksonville, where we were living there in the winter down in Georgia, southern Georgia. And they said, we can get her back to normal in a jiffy just by shocking her heart. It's called a heart shock. You put electrodes on your chest and bring it back to a heartbeat that's normal.
Right.
And they did that. And she's been normal ever since. So it's... And that, but that happened, the heart shock only happened a couple of months ago. So far she's in great shape. She's still taking medication. But that's what happened. And so during that period, I wrote a whole bunch of poems, I think out of terror.
Yeah.
It was both an escape and a way of dealing with it directly, with what happened. They weren't all about this. They were just about living in where we did. And my imagination was oddly triggered by all this. And so I suggest everybody live as if it's the last day of your or your wife's life.
Yeah.
You know? That came from all this. And the island in the poem really is, there's no island there at all, but I wrote a whole bunch of poems kind of related to the Odyssey.
Okay.
The Circe's Island.
Right.
And so there was kind of set in a mystical place.
Wonderful. Oh, that's cool.
And I just found that this is a good way to sort of place a lot of the poems. And then some of them are in the locales, but you'll see as I go through the other two poems what I'm talking about.
And I love how, if we're to talk actually about the poem, I love how the first line brings us right into, you know, both the story and the idea of story, and also the metaphor of, you know, the storm after the tidal tachycardia. There's clearly a strong understory going on, too, and I liked how that happens right away.
Thank you. It was an immediacy kind of thing. And, you know, one of the things that happened when I wrote this poem, what was helping me do this poem, was I developed a correspondence with Sidney Lee.
Oh, yeah.
And Sidney and I became really good friends over that period. And we were sending each other poems every week.
Yeah.
And to have this listener and this reader come back with his response to his own poems kind of pushed both of us on. So it was really a great correspondence.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It's still going on.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, it's funny. I'd love to be a fly on the wall at that correspondence because I've interviewed Sid a number of times as well. Okay, so I wanted to just mention one thing about this poem, which I found, I don't know, maybe this is just my imagination, but for some reason, the word princess and the word prayer kind of drew themselves together for me, and they're not even close to each other in the poem, but they both had this kind of reverence about them, and I felt like there was definitely an analogy being drawn between the garden-ensnared statue and the person at the end who's speaking in a soft voice. And I wondered if there's anything there.
Well, you know, when you do these things, you don't know how, obviously, things come in that are unconscious.
Right.
We have a beautiful statue of Guan Yin, you know, the goddess of compassion.
Right.
The Chinese goddess of compassion in our garden. I found it in an antique store. I don't know how it got there. A lot of things in the town that we live in Darien, Georgia, come off of boats, which stuff that was just dumped off of sea ships all the way through the 19th century. But anyway, so we bought this statue, put it in the garden, and the garden statue never fell down. But it does get ensnared by vines, which grow up very quickly in Georgia.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So that's what happened, and then there's a lot of storms around there that would I don't know if this storm was there or whether I just made it up.
Well, there was a big storm going on in your life, so
yeah, you're right. Wow.
Yeah.
And the idea of you know, somebody's there next to you, and then they wake up just for a moment, then go back to sleep, sweetly to sleep, and you're left with all this, you know. Are you going to talk to anybody about it? You know.
Yeah.
So. But it was really a fun. And I did, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, I think it's a sonnet. I'm not sure, I'm not counting the lines here, but I did a whole bunch of 14-line poems.
Okay.
And that was part of that series.
Yeah. Now Sid is a very formal poet. Do you use formality sometimes to help you with structure, or you seem more like a free writing poet?
Somewhat, actually. But I try to keep it hidden. a lot of these 14-liners are decasyllabic. They're 10-syllable lines.
Okay.
And there's a little bit of iambic stuff going on. So I do that. And then even when I've just gotten in the habit of doing decasyllabics, and I feel very happy with that, and I kind of rip along, and I'm a musician, so I sort of see this as a measure, like a musical measure.
Right. Now, do you tend to start writing just by kind of like riffing with images and stuff and then wrestle it into whatever pattern you might want it to fit? Or do you always keep, if you're going to be in any sort of form, do you keep that form up front when you're drafting?
Oh, no idea. Well, a lot of times I'll just write it out, but I'll write it out right away from the beginning in decasyllabic. I don't finally, you know, take a mess of stuff and then kind of chunk it up into 10-syllable lines. Those 10-syllable lines come to me fairly instinctively. But on the other hand, I will just kind of roll out something, you know, like on roller paper, and then decide on the stanzaic pattern I want. And I've gotten into a habit of writing five-line stanzas. And I published 2 poems this spring from the series, one in Plume, a literary magazine called Plume, and the other one in the Notre Dame Review, which used that five-line stanza pattern. And I've been doing a lot of that. I don't know, I just feel like comfortable in that particularly, that odd stanzaic pattern. Although the only 2 of these poems are actually, 2 of these poems are not stanzaic. The last one I sent you is.
Yeah. Well, actually, since you mentioned that one, should we skip to that one and do that one next?
Yeah. I'm a musician. I play with some guys down in Georgia quite often. And I play at a place called Jazzland in Jacksonville. Run by a woman named Carol. I've published another poem about her in my earlier book that we actually interviewed about.
Right.
So I'll read this with, and I think the story tells itself fairly well.
Okay.
It's called Text Message on the Way Home from Carol's Nonstop Bar. That's for Dan Silverman, a trombone player friend of mine who lives in Vermont. I like seeing me like this, lingering after hours, bone player unextraordinaire, bootstrapped into a facsimile of an early life, only with less hair. I weave in and out of the center lane in a movie I was made for, factory lights blinking in the beleaguered distance, one more last song of the night drifting with the thinning traffic. And when the song comes, nobody's ready for it. The bridge drops out and our chanteuse is fixing her gorgeous hair. As I drive, she sings, and the band rouses up for a last cacophonous chorus. A tanker truck floats by, and in the moment between one diminished chord and the next, I'm stuck on a memory of the first time I heard the trombone at a party where I also had my first drink, a moment I'm proud of considering circumstances. With a guy named Wiley's help, I held the horn. It would be too large to hold myself for another 5 years. And even now, that brass coil, its pure, smooth tubing, feels big and unwieldy. I put my lips inside the mouthpiece and blew. With just a try, I produced a low trombone growl and moved the slide far as I could with my short arms. The trombone sneered. I felt a mixture of terror and delight and knew with a frightening clarity what the rest of my life would be like. That my other loves would be fly-by-night affairs. Driving now north on I-95, I review my mileage, the bars I've been thrown out of, the temp of the tempo and time signatures that tell me how to get from here to there. There's lots of tunes about driving drunk and a few about stone-cold sobriety, where I find myself now. Hands annealed to the wheel, a low country moon pasted on an indigo sky. Does it get better than that? B-flat's the key for beginners, D-flat for cats speeding on jazz's corkscrew highway. Tonight at Carol's, I got my sharps and flaps confused. I was full of the Dickens, doing giant steps, changes in reverse mode on the trombone. Pure delight, that's what my horn gave me. Then silence filled the bar, a dismal silence I mistook for applause, and I was flung back into a dream of one of those old places you can't replicate with modern technology. Overhead fans twirling, white and black, tricked out in white cotton dresses at the bar. That memory scorched into the notes I wanted to play and dialed out of mine by random audio detritus on I-95. Something's on the blink. But if I listen hard enough, I hear us in a nowhere between two worlds. Dear heart, if you are receiving this text message, it is sent out of respect and gratitude for the help you've given me.
Thank you so much. There's a lot going on there. It's a wonderful poem.
And it actually is not in 10 syllable lines.
Oh, it's not.
It's not really, if you count the lines and not the syllables and that. Yeah, but usually I do, but this is just ripped off, you know?
Yeah, but it is in 5-line stanzas, correct?
One, two, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like seeing me like this is how the poem opens.
Well, I like seeing me like this, lingering after hours.
Yeah.
Well, I enjoy, obviously, I'm remembering what happened to me when I was playing in the bar. I got into the car and I started...
Yeah.
Reminiscing,
yeah.
I mean, about what had happened an hour before. So it's a poem about time, too, going back from the bar to childhood and then to the present, and then it references some music at the end, but not too much. One of the things it references is John Coltrane's Giant Steps,
right.
Which is an extremely complicated jazz tune.
Yeah.
Reference to D flat, that's a very difficult key for the trombone, so it's kind of bragging about how great I was. I realized that people really were not taken by what I did. So,
yeah, but depending on the crowd, you could have done an amazing job, and the right jazz crowd would have really appreciated it, and another crowd might not have gotten
it. I like to think that. I like to think that. But so. You know, it was just, I like writing about driving home from gigs. I've done quite a few poems about that,
yeah.
You know, because all kinds of random stuff happens, and then you can make a musical reference to it as you drive along.
Right. I liked that you were reminiscing about being a younger horn player and a beginner, you know, and it's always kind of fun to see that shift in time and talent and experience in a single poem. I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's really fun.
Yeah.
And then you write, there's lots of tunes about driving drunk and a few about stone cold sobriety where I find myself now. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about, I think there is a literature of addiction and you're part of it and your Drunk
right.
in the Woods is part of it too. And I wonder if you can talk about that and also being kind of a guide for the readers that are reading the literature of addiction.
Well, it's interesting. I could jump to the last essay in my book, Drunk in the Woods, just for a moment to mention that.
Sure.
That's about what happens after you're sober for 30 years.
Yeah.
There's so much is about early sobriety. But not a lot is written about people that have been sober for 30 years. And the question is, what do you do with that sobriety after all that time when there isn't really a roadmap to it?
Yeah.
You know, there isn't a roadmap to what you do after a certain time because the AA program, which was designed by two Vermont drunks, is about early sobriety. It's about, because they wrote it when they weren't more than 8 or 10 years sober.
Okay.
So that's in the back of my mind, a lot of this. But there's also a lot of literature. You know, as I said, there's a lot of literature about being drunk. And it's kind of easy to talk about that. And they're pretty obvious tropes that go along with that. They get kind of stale and old.
Yeah.
And but this is going beyond that, hopefully, into what you do now, you know?
Right, right. That's really interesting that there's not that kind of information out there after so many years. So that's different. That's good.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and that's really how my recent book, the finalist book, is Drunk in the Woods is really about. It's what do I do now, you know? And it's there are crises that continue to happen. Your wife gets sick. Things happen that you have to manage in different ways. That isn't in this poem at all, but that's part of the story.
No, but it sounds like you have written quite a lot of poetry in a short period of time that probably all feeds itself and tells a larger story, too.
Yeah, it does. Associations that I respond to as well, you know, as I'm going through. And I don't like to make I think one needs to be careful about having these arcane references that nobody can relate to but yourself and some knowing friends or something. So you got to keep it universal as much as you can.
Yeah. Well, you sent me a third poem, which I really like. I'm not sure we're going to have a lot of time to talk about it, but do you want to read it?
Yeah, that's the last poem I wrote.
Oh, okay. I think it's...
So they were getting better. and actually, I stole this title from somebody else's poem. And I can't remember whose it was, and I may have to change it. I just love the title, and I used it as a way to do this. And I've written quite a few poems about painting. Yeah. And actually, I've written a book about a medieval art, a book of poems about it. So that's kind of the concept of the artist in nature is interesting to me, and also an artist who's addicted. So I won't say anything more. I'll read the poem.
Okay.
Trout fishing with heroin addicts. Once emancipated from the compulsions of drapery, she lost no time setting to work. She thought of Corot's way of seeing things, how without fussiness he painted a pond reflecting trees, the very psychology of trees and the soft receding masses of branch and leaf. Details were details. They tripped you up. After all, it was September in leaf-strewn Vermont, and she was of the practical nature that characterizes the Swiss. At noon, to the muted colors, she set out to catch a trout. The idea of a trout by painting what it was not. Then the trout rose from the pond's pellucid depths. The pond looked like a Monet. She studied the needle marks between her toes, her junky legs, and fell into a catch-and-release frame of mind. It takes practice, the prep and so forth, she said, just as a big one surfaced a few feet away. She reeled in and cast again, and the fish struck her line, fading into a world she'd have painted with time. There's a sort of ritual. Don't forget the injection, the feeling. That feeling stayed all afternoon, digging into her like a claw. She reeled in the trout. It looked eerily young, inexperienced in the pleasures of spawning, and though free, it was still hooked on her line.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you. I did have a number of questions about it. I'm just going to pick a couple. I love the line about painting what something is not. That was beautiful. And I loved the comparison, sort of implied comparison, because not every reader is going to know exactly what you're talking about, but Corot versus Monet and the difference of going from, you know, detail to what is kind of a soft, unfocused art, I think.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's because she's trying to catch something by not catching it.
Right.
I guess I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
But and I've been looking at Corot for some reason. I picked up a little book about Corot in a bookstore in St. Simon's Island and just looked at those paintings a lot and wondered why I liked them so much because they seemed in a way so bland and so sort of dull and not at all. Well, it's definitely not impressionistic, although some people link her to him. He's a very feminine painter, I think, with the Impressionists.
Yeah, okay. And just the whole sort of, I mean, I wouldn't say it's too hard-hitting, but just the whole analogy between addiction and fishing, and specifically needles and hooks, I think, is probably where I would go if I wanted to get really specific. But
yeah.
I just liked that all lingering in the background as I read the poem.
Yeah, and I didn't really think about it. Quite frankly, this came in a couple of days, and I didn't think of that, although it came to the end, and I said, wow, what a great way to end this thing.
Yeah.
Still caught on her line, and yet it was free.
Yeah.
So that came to me with an it was a eureka moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think one of the most fun things about reading poetry is that it can be a eureka moment for your reader, too.
Good point. Yeah. It was supposed to be some... I was laughing as I did the poem. It was just so much fun to do these things and have these juxtapositions appear as I went through them, you know?
Right.
It was written in Georgia, but it was also anticipating my trip back to Vermont, which happened a few weeks later.
Yeah. Well, Tony, I hate to say it, but we are out of time. But I want to repeat that I've been speaking with Tony Whedon, and your most recent book was Drunk in the Woods, published by Green Writers Press, and that's the one that got nominated for the Vermont Book Award, and that's essays. Lots of poetry out there, including a collection we talked about a few years ago, and I look forward to your next one.
Well, that's wonderful. Thanks so much, and thanks for your perceptions and guiding me through these poems.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Vermont writer and musician Tony Whedon. You can learn more about his work at tonywhedon.com. In the coming weeks, Tony's going to be leading a 6-session workshop in Montgomery, Vermont. The classes will meet at 6 on August 14th and 28th, September 10th and 25th, and October 9th and 16th. Here's an excerpt of his description. In this 6-session workshop, we'll be writing fiction and essays, and looking at work by other writers to stimulate discussion and to provide models for our own writing. There are no requirements, educational or otherwise, except the desire to participate and tell your own story. He adds that poetry will not be turned away if that's what you're writing these days. You can get more information by emailing him at tonywhedon@gmail.com, and his last name is W-H-E-D-O-N. If you'd like to share Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know, you already know all this, that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and Spotify and lots of other places, including writethebook.podbean.com, as free podcasts. You can get updates on Twitter and Facebook by looking at Write the Book on each of those venues. You can also access the podcast at my own website, SheLaughsWithoutUs.com. If you go to my website, you'll also see a new tab, hashtag book giveaway. If you're interested in any of the books that you've heard on the show, you can ask if I still have my copy. And if I still have it, I will send it to you. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Have a great week.